You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Jan Jättelöv. He's in Stockholm right now. Jan, thanks so much for being with me today.
Well, thank you, too.
Jan, let's begin with what you're working on now. I know there's several projects, curatorial work and other work. Can you tell me a little bit, an overview of what are you working on at the moment?
Well, I work on various levels in terms of artistic practice and theoretical work and curatorial. And one recent project, which I finished only last week, was a curatorial work for the U.S. Ambassador Azita Raji at her residence in Stockholm.
And what did that project consist of?
The ambassador asked me to present some emerging Swedish artists for her, and we decided to go for one in particular. It's Ludmila Kristiseva. She is a Belarus-born artist who lives and works in Sweden.
That seems like kind of an unusual commission. I mean, it's for a residency or a curatorial work. Is that a private residence, or is it a kind of an international residency, or where artists, you know, stay at or work at?
No, it's the ambassador's private residence.
That sounds fantastic. So this is a temporary installation there.
It is a temporary 2 months installation. Yes, I think it's the first time ever anyone does something like it.
That's wonderful. And can you just describe a little bit what the installation is and the issues or concerns it addresses?
The title is War's Unwomanly Face, and the piece consists of 30 sculptures all in all, but we show only 8 of them in the ambassador's garden, and they are in a human size and made of a toile, which is a fabric. The first piece you make, if you ask a seamster or tailor to do a suit or a gown for you, on which the final piece later is modeled. And so these toiles were dipped in plastic and hardened, and they are shown in the garden and lit from the inside in the night.
Fascinating. And this, how long will that installation be there?
Until the beginning of November.
Very good. And perhaps we should move on to some of your writing. Is there some writing you're working on now? I'm interested also in talking about the writing that you've done about architectural and even sexual identity in architecture. But is there a piece of writing that you're working on now that we should discuss?
Yes, I am. I'm working on 2 different books. The first one is related to my own work. It bears the title Men at Water, which is a book collecting the final results of a project I've been working on for the last 2 or 3 years. It consists of the results of research in archives and also an exhibition, and it will also contain an interview. Now, this is a project which investigates the turn of the previous century Swedish painter Irene Jansson. And work he did, paintings he did at the Royal Naval Baths in Stockholm at the turn of the previous century.
And there's a second book you're working on.
Yes, it's a commission to translate the first uncensored version of The Picture of Dorian Gray to Swedish.
So say that again. Talk to me a little bit about that. That's the first translation. What is exactly the approach to The Picture of Dorian Gray?
The uncensored version of The Picture of Dorian Gray.
Oh, The Uncensored, right? When it so previously, right, when Dorian Gray was first released, it was fairly quickly censored until I don't know how much later, but previously the uncensored version wasn't released in Sweden.
Well, the first uncensored version came in English 2011, so it was actually censored by the editors already in 1890, before it was published. So what we have to deal with is two different scripts, one in longhand and one the typescript, and so I'm looking at both of these versions.
And when you say the longhand, you're looking at Oscar Wilde's handwriting of the manuscript?
Yes, the first.
That's fascinating. So I'd love to know a little more about that. How is it different? I mean, I remember hearing, you know, when I first read it, that there was, you know, more overt homosexual love or something, you know, within it, gay and, you know, lesbian love. But is that essentially what was censored? Is it a type of sexuality, or what is it?
Well, the sex bit was censored out of various reasons. I don't think the publishers really—they were actually well known for publishing rather advanced books on this topic, sexuality. And the Picture of Dorian Gray is one in a series they did. But they also understood the limits of the law, and they censored the text due to this particular reason. Then what also happened was that they normalized the language. Oscar Wilde's punctuation and grammar wasn't what one would say easily or normative, I don't know how to put it. So it was normalized and made, or also simplified. What we have now, the version released in 2011, is something which is closer to the original. And it's also, it's much fresher when it comes to language.
That's so interesting. I didn't know that it was that much an edited text, a censored text. So his language, you're saying, was somewhat difficult, or it was normalized. I mean, what does that mean exactly? Was the language was it actually hard to read? Was it not written as well as it could have been, or is there something in essence that we're missing with all that censoring that lack of normalization? Sounds like it could be particularly characteristic of him and the charm of the book, but is it?
When it comes to wording, he's inconsequent, and in the finalized version, wording was made more consequent. He uses different versions with the same meaning when it comes to particular words, and also when it comes to descriptions of scenes. You have extremely long sentences, and when it comes to dialogue, it's very much more like his plays. It's almost as if you could actually hear these dialogues being read out loud, and that was altered to adjusted for more for an American reader, actually.
Huh, that's so fascinating. And so now, you know, having, you know, you're one of the people who's read the censored version, you're working on an uncensored version. What will the uncensored version, how different will that be? Will that reassess, you know, what we think of Oscar Wilde as a, he's already a brilliant writer, but is that a significant reassessment of that whole book?
Well, yes, as I said, it was published by Belknap, Harvard University Press, in 2011. I think it's actually changed the general public's idea of Oscar Wilde's writing. I think it did. And let me also say that the 2011 version is the original and not as long as the later published novel, which most of us have read. It contains less of heterosexual alliances, and for instance, you have Dorian Gray's relation with a girl or several girls. This was later changed and made different by Oscar Wilde himself for the longer novel version.
That's interesting. I remember, you know, reading that, you know, rereading that book to actually my son. It was one of the last books I read him when he was around 11 or 12. And it struck me then, this was several years ago, that there was, and perhaps this level of detail is still the same, but that there are all these things insinuating that's happening at the end, these kind of depraved things, perhaps, or that this character is doing. But we don't know what those things are. We can only kind of guess at it. Which, you know, it was drugs and I suppose some wanton sexuality or something. But is that what's happening? Are there more details about what's actually happening to the character at the end as he kind of descends into this place of unknown activities? You know, we don't know what the activities are.
Well, yeah, I would say that the sexuality is more explicit in this uncensored version, absolutely, and also the immorality of the whole story is more explicit. Already on the first pages, you have Lord Henry smoking opium-tinted cigarettes, for instance, which in later versions was deleted. And you also have the artist Basil Howard proclaiming his love and care for Dorian Gray in a completely different sense and more explicit than in later versions. Yes, I would say that it's a different story.
Very interesting. I'm so glad we talked about that. So perhaps we should talk about one more thing, and maybe this is a good segue to talk about architecture and sexuality and how you've approached that or written about that.
Yes, we could absolutely do that. I fairly recently accomplished a PhD in architecture about a villa built in the mid-1700s. It's Strawberry Hill. It still stands in Twickenham, just outside the centre of London.
And that's a 17th century farmhouse, right, that we're talking about, that still stands?
Yes. In 1746, Horace Walpole first rented and then purchased a farmhouse, which he rebuilt in several stages. I'm writing about the first 10 years. And why do I do that? Because he lived at this house together with up to three other men at the same time, and they together as a community rebuilt this house to fit their particular social needs and demands. It was a house built for four men and not for husband, wife, and children and whatnot. So it actually, because of these social demands, changed the notion of an English country house. And by that, it also, according to my thesis, is the first seed or the first version of what we know today as the modern villa, the bourgeois villa.
It's fascinating. So, you know, I know in the writing that you've done about this, because we're talking about, and just correct me if I'm wrong, a type of sexuality implicit in the architecture. It was the photographs of this farmhouse that in part led your research, which fascinated me. And just again, correct me if I'm wrong, but just photographs of bedrooms with impressions of bodies and senses, a sense imbued in photography, I suppose, as well as the architecture of the unusual nature of this house and how and its sexual identity, so to speak.
Sorry, I lost you there. What was the question?
The question is: so, are you saying in some of those photographs, that's partly what you know? I'm trying to get at that term. Kind of sexual identity of the architecture is. I understand the house was rebuilt that way, as you were saying, or designed to house these four men. But how else did that, was that implied? And because you talk about the photographs, so I'm interested in the photographs of the place and how that informed your research.
Yes. What I did was that I actually investigated and studied what's left from the time being, actually. Not much photograph, if I may correct you. Rather documents. I went, for instance, to the Lewis Walpole Library at Yale University and looked through what they have in their archives regarding sketches, paintings, ink and wash drawings, letters, to see how this particular house actually was built more from the inside and the process behind each particular development rather than the final result. The final result still stands, and it's fairly recently been renovated splendidly by the National Trust. I think a £10 million scheme or something like that. And I wasn't too interested in that, actually. I was more interested in the documents from the 1700s, and I wanted to compare drawings with letters and try to come closer to some sort of process.
A process of how they approach the redesign of the rebuilding, you mean?
Yes, and what sort of social streams of consciousness you can find behind each particular detail. For instance, one member of this household, we don't know exactly in which room he slept, and I tried to find out that. And where actually in the house this bedroom, this chambre was situated, and why particular rooms had a certain color, things like that. But it's an interesting villa because what you have in Britain at the time being is a wave of neoclassicism. And Horace Walpole and his friends, they go straight against that current. They reintroduces the Gothic as an alternative to the classicism in England. And I look at this from certain philosophy introduced by Inigo Jones, and he writes about classicism as something which is connected with masculinity, and he writes about it in his diary 1614, already. And the idea of the facade as an example of the builder's status in society is introduced in English Architecture by Inigo Jones. And he writes that the facade should consist of solid materials such as marble or brick, and brick is something one could possibly use out on the countryside, but marble always in town, town palaces. And whereas the interior could be feminine and more frivolous and consists of fabric, wood, plaster, more temporary material. And this is an interesting dichotomy. He actually says that femininity is something which is ruled by a masculine facade.
That's fascinating. So interesting, you know, it goes back a little bit to Oscar Wilde, but I've always been fascinated about exactly how Oscar Wilde designed his building in London after reading the biography. Apparently there are very few images and documents of that as well, but it was somehow also a quite unusual design, I think, for the decade that was when he was living there.
Yes, Oscar Wilde had a house on Tite Street, and if I remember it correctly, it was one of the first white interiors, and he collected blue china, didn't he? And this was something completely new in London, and I guess in the world, a bright white interior as opposed to heavy fabrics, brocade, and so on and so forth.
It's been wonderful talking to you, Jan. I want to close by asking you what books you're reading now, which I can probably imagine, but can you tell us what you're working on? What you're reading at the moment?
I'm reading Les Liaisons Dangereuses by Leclos.
And why that particular book?
It's based on a series of letters, obviously mock letters, but I'm interested in the format, and also about the narrative part, which is how emotions and feelings are manipulated by the main characters. Manipulating other people, yes, it's an interesting and cruel intrigue.
Well, thank you, Jan. I want to thank you for talking with me today. It's really been a pleasure to discuss your work with you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.